Mark Campbell. Getting High with Ida off his new album, Tantric Machine. On the line, we have Mr. Mark Campbell with us, the lead vocalist of 1980s punk band The Nails and a solo artist. Thank you for joining us, Mark. How are you?
I'm good, Ian. How are you?
I am excellent.
Great.
Mark, first we'll talk about the work. First we'll talk about your work with The Nails, and then we'll talk about your recent solo release, Tantric Machine. The five members of The Nails were a diverse group of people. How did you meet up with them?
Well, it was 19. I'm really aging myself here, but it was 1976 in Boulder, Colorado, and there weren't nothing going on in Boulder at that time. It was the seat of John Denver, Rocky Mountain High, this kind of innocuous, bland hippie music, and I was. I was a poet, I was a young writer, and I'd always been into rock and roll, but the early 70s and mid-70s were a very bleak period for rock, unless you were into stuff like Genesis or Yes, Electric Light Orchestra, that kind of bombastic art rock. And I was just kind of fed up with rock as it was, and I decided to form a band, partially inspired by picking up the first Ramones album, and subsequently the first Patti Smith album, and of course The Clash and then The Pistols. But just before that, I think it really was Patti Smith's and the Ramones' first couple albums that really fired me up. And I put up a message on the local university bulletin board. I wasn't a student at the time, looking for musicians who were interested in backing me up as I read poetry, essentially. And I found a couple of guys. David Kaufman initially contacted me, and after that, Artie and various other people who never actually got as far as recording on any of the first Nails albums for RCA, but these were the guys who, went out on a limb, and though they didn't quite understand my vision at the time, they were still listening to Steely Dan and the Grateful Dead. And I remember bringing the first Ramones album to rehearsal and saying, listen to this, it's a religious experience.
Absolutely.
They listened to it, and they did not get it. They thought I was out of my mind. But at my insistence, and they repeatedly listened to the thing, and I think they finally saw the light. And at that point, we just started writing our own stuff, and it was basically a big, I've got a note to myself not to curse, so it was basically a big F.U., to the local Rocky Mountain music scene. I just wanted to create some trouble, be a turd in the punch bowl, shake things up, and we managed to do that.
Absolutely, absolutely. Listening to your Dangerous Dreams album, you guys remind me a lot of The Doors, and since you've told me that you started out reading poetry over music, it only makes me think it more so. Were The Doors a big influence to you in addition to Patti Smith? And I know The Doors are one of Patti Smith's big influences.
Yeah, absolutely. Jim Morrison, I don't know how old you are, Ian. I'm figuring probably, mid-20s?
21.
So imagine, if you can, being 15 or 16 years old and hearing the first Doors album. And hearing it with ears that had up until then really only been exposed to the usual teeny bopper junk that was on the radio at that time. Now, I had heard some Bob Dylan, and of course I was into, some of the early kind of garage bands, but, the Kingsmen, the Sonics, and stuff like that. But basically, being a suburban kid in 1967 and hearing the first Doors album was just mind-boggling. It was the first time I'd heard a rock and roll artist dealing with stuff other than cars and girls, but dark things and the kinds of frightening things that you imagine as a young person but couldn't articulate. And it was liberating to hear somebody roughly in your age group articulating these kind of profound, deep, unsettling, quasi-religious, shamanistic sensibility that Morrison was doing at that time. And then you couple that with good, clean LSD, which was available, and it was like amazing.
Absolutely, absolutely.
It was a mind-changing kind of music. Remember when music could change your mind? You know, there's not much of that available right now, though. I think we are going through some kind of a renaissance.
Do you think it's a good renaissance or a no good renaissance?
Stuff out there, I've been listening to the new Arcade Fire album, and I've always liked them very much. To me, there's a lot of beauty in that. Otherwise, it is relative. I like Fever Ray, a good Swedish band with kind of dark side. And,
yeah.
You know, there's a handful of artists that I'm digging, and I like good dumb pop music from time to time. I'm not an elitist, but in terms of music that really can change your consciousness, I don't hear a lot of it anymore. And that's what Morrison did for me. That's what Hendrix did for me. They just changed your whole life.
Absolutely, absolutely. For me, something I've noticed a lot of, I guess what you're feeling, stagnation in the rock music world, a lot of loss of content. And it's interesting that you should mention Fever Ray, because to me it seems like all the ground being broken in the modern music world is in electronic music, just because those instruments are new, you can do new things with them, and they're inspiring to musicians. Do you listen to much electronic music?
Well, it's interesting you should bring that up. There's a clip of Jim Morrison. I don't know if you've seen it. It's on YouTube. But Jim is talking about what he imagines the future of rock and roll to be. And in this clip, and as I said, it's readily available on YouTube. In this clip, Morrison talks for about 2 or 3 minutes about how he imagines that the rock and roll of the future, and keep in mind he's saying this in the late 60s, early 70s, sometime around then. I can't remember when Jim died, but he's talking about the future of rock and roll, and he says it's going to be musicians playing electronic instruments using tape loops. He's talking about sampling. He's talking about, synthesizers and drum machines, though he doesn't specifically use those words. That's what he's talking about. So Morrison saw it coming, and I agree with you. I mean, to me, if you could couple the lyrics of a guy like Jim Morrison or Patti Smith or, and I don't want to seem lacking humility here, but somebody like myself who's striving to write something with some depth, you couple that with really good, hard-driving electronic beats. I've never figured out why artists like, Patti, and even myself, though I've thought about it, haven't gotten and explored dance music more. Because that's where the production is really awesome, when you listen to some of the electronic stuff, in terms of ambience and also in terms of just intensity. Killing Joke kind of explored that somewhat.
Absolutely. I actually played Killing Joke early on my show, and that's one of the things I like about them, was just how true they were to classic rock and roll and how much they embraced, I guess, the harder edge side of electronic music.
Yeah, they were fabulous. They were amazing, and maybe still are. I don't know if they've toured in recent years, but they were amazing live. One of those kinds of live experiences where you walk away and everything that I was doing at the time seemed diminished somewhat. I wanted my music to get harder. I wanted it to get more in your face. The thing about the Nails, though, we kind of started in the punk era. We were really, except for some very early recordings, we were never really a punk rock band, though people have called us that just because we came up during the punk scene. And we were in New York playing CBGBs and Max's and all that stuff. But the Nails really were very musical. And not because of me. I'm a primitive musician, but I surrounded myself with guys who could really play. So we were almost too smart and musical to really be a punk band. And, you know, you're very right in making the Doors connection. I mean, it was the Doors, the Velvet Underground. I want, and Patty, later, you know, the first couple of U2 albums, you know, early Springsteen, you know, music that really aspires toward almost a certain spirituality, a certain holiness, you know, and I'm not talking about religion here, you know, I'm talking about the music that can transform you. So I always aspired to that. You know, I wasn't a nihilist. I wasn't, you know, I wasn't out like, you know, the Pistols.
Yeah, yeah.
To destroy, you know. I wanted to kind of transform. And I really feel that rock has that capacity. And I think you know that. I know that. Great rock and roll music is our church, you know. For those who aren't practicing Christians, that's been my church. It's been my only religion, you know, so to speak.
Absolutely, absolutely. Along the same lines, I feel like punk did a lot of tearing down, as you said, and the post-punk music movement, which I would personally associate with you, the Nails, with, did a lot of reconstructing. While you were in the Nails, are there any other bands that you looked up to?
Yeah, and that was part of the problem. I've always thought that I've been a fanboy first and a songwriter, musician second. I mean, if I heard a band I'd really like, I'd invariably go into a rehearsal studio with my group, with the Nails, and try to pull in some of the elements of whoever I was knocked out by at any particular moment. So as a result, a lot of the Nails' early stuff is all over the map musically. You know, at times it sounds Doorsy, at times it sounds Velvet Undergroundy. There's some early tracks that we recorded that where we sound like the B-52s. I mean, we were Air Ubu, where we were playing around with, you know, these kind of surf beats. And, you know, I mean, it was really whatever. I was very, very easily influenced. And I would get excited if I'd hear something that knocked me out. If I heard Killing Joke, you know, or if I heard, well, hearing Joy Division just kind of confirmed my Doorsy sensibilities anyway. But when I heard, you know, the first Joy Division stuff, and I went, my God, you know, this stuff is great, and, you know, I want to sound truer to myself. You know, I want to get down to what really inspired me initially. So there would be these little wake-up calls. You know, I'd hear Joy Division, I'd go, man, I got to stop doing this, you know, whatever it was that I was doing at the time, and get back to my Velvet Underground Doors roots, you know.
Absolutely.
So I was very easily influenced. You can hear that on our two albums that are recorded for RCA. They really, really are, you know, all over the map musically, which is not necessarily a bad thing. What unifies them, if anything, are my lyrics.
Absolutely, absolutely. The Nails' most famous song, 88 Lines About 44, in the Nails' most famous song, 88 Lines About 44 Women, you say Bobby joined the new wave band that changed her name to Bobby Sox. Were there any musical movements going on in the 1980s that you didn't like when you were with the Nails?
That I didn't?
That you felt kind of embodied the, I guess, hollowness that you dislike in music that you originally formed the Nails to escape from.
Yeah, but I even liked them. You know? I mean, Duran Duran, Frankie Goes to Hollywood, you know, all that stuff was hollow, but it was fun. I mean, and Tears for Fears, not so much, but, you know, they were a little too angst-ridden in a kind of wimpy way, but I like the humor of Frankie Goes to Hollywood. I like, you know, the big, you know, kind of new wavy disco thing that Duran, you know, we were dancing back then. You got to keep in mind that in New York City at the time, you know, the whole disco punk thing had kind of converged after a long period of being at each other's throats. You know, we wouldn't go uptown to Studio 54, and the Studio 54 people wouldn't come downtown. But in the early 80s, that barrier broke down, and bands like the Bush Tetras and Liquid Liquid and, you know, started playing these deep, funky grooves while maintaining a kind of punk lyrical attitude. So we were in the clubs dancing, and Duran Duran was great to dance to, and so was, you know, a lot of that stuff that sounds hollow, but it was functionally, you know, party music and cocaine music, and it worked within those parameters, you know. There were a few of those bands. I mean, I loved ABC. I don't know if you remember them, but Martin Fry's band, it was a very kind of disco-y band, but they had their tongues firmly planted in their cheek. You know, they were kind of like a Roxy Music kind of thing. But the 80s, looking back on it, there aren't great, great bands, you know. Somebody just died the other day. Michael Benn of The Call just died at the age of 60. He was touring with his son's band, Black Rebel Motorcycle Club. He was doing sound for them, and he died of a heart attack in Belgium, or in Berlin, excuse me. But Michael Benn and The Call, dig them up, grab them, play them, because that was a great band that was grossly underrated. And there were a few, you know. But, you know, I think when we think about 80s music, we think of that slick, glossy, fashion-oriented type music. But there were some good bands that were floating around.
Absolutely. I've seen The Call in various locations, but I've never picked them up. Their albums always look cool, but I wasn't quite sure. I will pick them up at the next opportunity possible.
Do it, man. You're in, you know that, again, I write for a website called Dangerous Minds. It's a pretty cool site, and I wrote a piece about Michael the other day. You know, he was somebody who, when I would listen to his music and go into the studio, I know it was seeping into my own writing. He had a kind of a Clash-like, you know, kind of political, anthemic, little bit of Springsteen, a little bit of Clash, a little bit of U2. But he was aspiring to something big and powerful.
Absolutely. Do you have a, changing subjects, do you have a Nails album with which you're particularly happy, or that you feel like is the Nails' best album?
Not really, you know, but I'm highly critical of everything that I do when it comes to music. And the Nails were caught up in the glamour, to be honest with you. We started out as part of a movement to destroy, not destroy, but to create an alternative to the status quo in the established music industry. Okay, I never thought in a million years I was going to get a record deal. What I was doing was a form of guerrilla theater. I started a rock and roll band because I could, and I wanted to, and I wanted to make a statement. Like, I remember going on local radio in Boulder, Colorado, and as a guest, this was 1977, and I brought some Clash singles and some Ramones and stuff to play on the air. And as the DJ kind of put the things on the turntable, played them, and I can tell he was in agony. You know, he just wasn't getting it. And he says, "Well, Mark, if this music is so good, you know, why isn't it getting played on radio?" And I said, "Because you, DJs, are the SS troops of musical fascism in this country," which really went over like a lead balloon. The telephone lines were lighting up, and all the hippies in Boulder were calling outraged, you know. You know, how can you call the Clash music? How can you call the Ramones music? It's crap. But the bottom line is, that's the movement I was part of. That's the swell of energy I was engaged in at the time. Never thought I'd be in a rock and roll band as a professional. And, you know, 88 Lines, about 44. We went to New York to play CBGB's. We had to go to Mecca. You know, CBGB's was the Mecca. And we drove, you know, whatever, the 1,400 miles to play audition night on a Monday. Our roadie at the time was Jello Biafra, Eric, who later formed, as you know, the Dead Kennedys. And remember him putting all our stuff in our van in Boulder and waving goodbyes. We drove off into the sunset to play CBGB's. But we, you know, we never thought of ourselves as, you know, future rock stars. I didn't sit on the edge of my bed at night writing songs thinking, yeah, I'll make a million off of this one. You know, we just got caught up in the energy. We were doing it because we believed in it. We loved it. So when we got a record deal, you know, it was a shock, to be honest. And it was generated by interest in a little tune we wrote called 88 Lines About 44 Women. Record deals came, record labels came sniffing around after that homemade single of ours had gotten picked up by John Peel on BBC Radio. So suddenly big labels came around, and I got a big-ass, you know, label deal. And I bought into the jive hook, line, and sinker. You know, our first album cost $35,000 to make. Our second one cost $350,000.
Wow. That's really amazing.
Emmy recording the second one with the guy who had produced the New Romantics, not the New Romantics, but the Romantics. It's What I Like About You. And he'd produced Ted Nugent, the foul, evil Ted Nugent. And, you know, here I am in Miami, you know, recording at one of the best recording studios in the world, staying in a nice hotel, you know, sorting blow at night and driving around after hours with, you know, hookers. Bought into it, hook, line, and sinker. And so under those, in that kind of atmosphere, we made these album, the second album, and it is good. It's powerful. But I got caught up in all the effects, you know, all the echo, all the syndromes, stuff that I now listen to and really wish weren't there. I wish I had done something raw, more personal, less embellished with all the glitzy, gimmicky sounds of the 80s. I think they're better than most of the stuff that came out in the 80s, but they still suffer from those kind of corny, excessive production things. But we were so, you know, we were so enamored of it. We were so starstruck by being able to use all that equipment, you know.
Is that what you're going for on your new album, Tantric Machine, is a raw, less caught up in the production sound?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, with the new one, I literally sat down with my friend Hugh Poole and recorded this thing using the cheapest equipment we can, deliberately. I mean, we had access to wonderful equipment had we wanted it, but we decided to take pawn shop synthesizers and microphones, stuff that were antiques, essentially. I mean, rinky-dinky little Casio drum machines and stuff like that. And I wanted to do something that sounded as if some kind of a post-apocalyptic record, as if we had dug up the instruments and stuff out of the rubble of the dead civilization, so to speak. And so we used a lot of old stuff, and we ran it through lots of old effects, machines. Yes, we were using, you know, the studio in ways that I had used it before, but not to make some kind of sheeny, shiny epic, but to make something that sounded, again, decayed, ancient a little bit. And I used some samples from some old soul records, and which you can hear on stuff like Funky Substance, Getting High with Ida, which you just played, has a drum loop in it that, you know, we just programmed into an old rhythm machine. And, you know, in a way, that's how we did it with 88 Lines in the beginning. That's why 88 Lines has been used, you know, by, back in the day, by rappers into mixes. Afrika Bambaataa would drop 88 Lines into mixes because it had that goofy little Casio rhythm track, and it was kind of like proto white boy rap for the time. There really weren't, you know, I mean, other than Lou Reed's Walk on the Wild Side, it was kind of one of the first semi-white rap things. So on this new thing, I kind of went back to some of that, and you know, there's some country elements in the new thing. I don't know where that came from. I was born in Texas. I'm thinking it's genetic.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. You know, as a teenager, I grew up in your neck of the woods, you know, in Virginia. But so, I, you know, there was a little bit of that, too, you know, growing up, you know, on the East Coast and listening to some of the country stations out there as well. And I don't know. I really don't know where it came from. But it's a unique little piece of work, and I'm really happy with it because I think there's a warmth to it and a certain intimacy that my albums with the Nails kind of lacked.
I certainly don't think your albums with the Nails lack intimacy.
Thank you.
Even knowing the backstory. But I do think your new album is a really intimate album. I really sympathize with a lot of your viewpoints, even though I'm a lot younger than you, which is really amazing to me. How long did it take you to record Tantric Machine?
It didn't take long, and that was part of the idea. After the Nails albums had been released on RCA, we attempted a third album on our own. We were no longer with RCA. We kind of had to make the decision whether to toss in the towel or continue, and continuing was what we had to do. And we recorded an album called Corpus Christi in demo form. It's subsequently, it has appeared. You can purchase it, but don't. It's not authorized. It's basically was taken from us and released without our permission. And as I said, it's demo stuff. But that was the last thing we did. And I kind of was just so dismayed by the experience of having that record released without our permission and the whole dubious nature of the whole music business. It's completely turned me off. So I got out of it for a while. And then, of course, you know, like all addictions, the hunger, you know, kind of came back up. And I decided I'm going to make a solo album. I bought a Rickenbacker, an old 60s Rickenbacker guitar, because I always buy a guitar before I start a new bunch of songs. It guilt trips me. I see that $3,000 guitar staring at me in the corner saying, use me. So I bought the guitar to kind of guilt trip myself into actually writing. I wrote and wrote and went into the studio in Tribeca, New York, Hugh's little homemade studio. And, you know, three or four nights a week, we'd get together with some wine and all this funky equipment, and we'd just go. And most of the stuff are first takes. There's very little overdubs. You know, obviously, there were just two of us for some of the tracks, so we're working with rhythm machines and stuff, and there's a handful of, you know, guitar overdubs and stuff. But mostly, it's pretty organic. And then we went into a studio in Brooklyn called Excella with some musicians, people who had been in Pear Ubu and Brian Miller, who's worked with Dylan and a handful of people that I knew, and did a few more tracks. But the idea was to do them quick, try to do as many first takes as possible with very little overdubbing, and keep it as real as possible, even when we're using electronic instruments, I mean, not like drum machines and samples. We wanted a certain warmth, and I think I managed to do it.
So what led ultimately to the dissolution of the Nails was the corporate record industry?
Yeah, I mean, keep in mind that we were essentially together off and on for almost 25 years, which is a very long time for a band to be together. We weren't touring all that time. We weren't playing clubs. But we would get together and write and record. And we always had another project in mind. Right now, I think there's probably about 30 rough tracks, which, you know, would make a couple of great Nails albums. And it's some of the best stuff we ever did. And maybe it will see the light of day. But the music in you know, we started out in that punk thing, and that whole DIY, do-it-yourself movement, of saying to the music industry, we're not going to come and beg at your feet for a record deal. We're going to start our own record labels. And it was very prophetic, because essentially that's what's happening now. The music industry has been destroyed. I mean, the Sex Pistols, you know, even though they were on A&M, I mean, they were out to destroy, you know, in a theatrical sense, the music industry. So we're the punks, to kind of blow the whole status quo apart, to say, you know, you thrive off of the musicians. We don't need you. Without you, without us, this industry is nothing. And it is. The arrogance of those record labels, you have no idea what it was like being on a major record label in the early 80s, walking into these offices where these no-talent A&R people and public relations people, you know, with lines, you know, the size of your arm on their desks, who have absolutely no love for the musicians or the music, you know, were running things, you know, but without us, they were nothing, you know, and we figured that out. So, but the results are, you know, there's no more $300,000 advancers. There's no more tour support for young, struggling musicians, et cetera. You know, you've either got your mega stars, you know, U2, Lady Gaga, Justin Bieber, whatever, and then you've got the struggling musicians. There's really not much of a rock and roll middle class anymore. In the 80s, it was possible. You could do 200-300 tours a year out of a van and somehow make it happen. But, you know, the independent record stores have closed. Gasoline is expensive. There's a lot of reasons that, you know, it's not economically viable anymore for a band to get in a van and tour. Some still do, but far fewer than were doing it in the 80s. So I guess my point is we've pretty much succeeded in neutralizing the music industry, and we've opened it up so anybody can make a record. Anybody can, you know, upload a song to YouTube or whatever. And the problem is very few people are making money doing it anymore. You know, the jackpot, you know, of getting that record deal really doesn't exist anymore.
And is that how you'd like to promote your future solo work, is through the internet?
Well, I have no choice. You know, I mean, the way the bands are currently making money, they're touring. You know, I mean, Arcade Fire offered up their new album on Amazon for what, $3.99? They're not making any money off of that, but they're making a tremendous amount of money off of their current tour. So they're basically giving their music away, and that's the way it's working right now. And the idea of putting together a band and touring behind a record is a little daunting for me at this point. I'm certainly willing to do it, and I'm looking forward to doing it. But, you know, you've got to factor in, you know, pulling together musicians, rehearsing, booking a tour. You know, I don't think there's money to be made on the internet in any kind of, you know, substantial life-supporting kind of way for an artist who isn't a megastar. I think there are other ways that you can make money, and I've made money off of my music being used in commercials and on television. And that's the other thing, you know. There's certain songs on my new album that are dark and probably would fit in perfectly on an episode of, what's the vampire show on TV? True Blood. You know, Dexter used one of my tunes in an ad campaign, 88 Lines. So that's where a lot of my peers, you know, a lot of the guys that came up out of the 80s are making money off of soundtracks. John Doe from X is on a True Blood soundtrack. BB's, Chris Stamey. So it's an interesting new arena.
Absolutely, absolutely. So as of right now, you're not exactly sure what your plans as in the future are with the record industry in the state it is.
Well, I'm releasing the record, or CD. I have a website, tantricmachine.com, and we're going to release it sometime in the next, I don't know, 2 or 3 months. I've just got to get all my ducks in a row. You know, I've got to promote it properly. I want to just put this thing out and have it, and have nobody know about it. You know, I have a history, and it's a good one. And I know people have, you know, the Two Nails albums have been recently re-released, finally, on CD, to very good reviews, and they've been selling very well. So I know there are people out there who dig my music. It's just a question of how do I let them know it's available and how do I get it to them? And that's what I'm working on now. You know, I'll definitely release it as a CD because I still want people to have something to hold in their hand. And I'll also release it in some digital format, you know, for download, obviously. But it's the promotion. You know, certainly this radio interview is lovely and I've done a couple of others, but I need to really kind of come up with a strategy. And maybe I need to make some kind of a very scandalous YouTube video, like MIA's Born Free, you know, where a bunch of kids are having their heads blown off. You know what I'm saying? Or what Erykah Badu did in Dallas when she walked through Dealey Plaza naked. Those are good ideas. That gets attention.
Well, if I ever see a video of you walking through...
I like turtles.
You walking naked on YouTube, Mark, I'll know why.
It takes something, man. You know, one of the things of freeing up music for everybody, which the internet has done, is that there are now millions and millions of people uploading music, and a lot of it is really bad. I mean, really bad. So how do you find the good stuff, you know? You can go to Pitchfork, but there's such a bunch of elitist, you know, tight asses that, you know, their range of taste is more narrow than, you know, Ted Nugent's fans. But you know, so how do you get the word out? That's the deal, Ian.
There you have it, folks. Mark Campbell of the Nails. Thanks for joining us, Mark. It's been a pleasure, and WUVT Blacksburg would like to wish you the best of luck in the future.
Thank you, Ian. Keep in mind, it's tantricmachine.com, and I'm on Facebook as Mark Campbell. And anybody who wants to friend me, I'm open.
There you have it. Mark Campbell is open for friend requests. That was Mark Campbell, everybody. Lead vocalist of the Nails from back in the 1980s. Nails have just reissued their Hotel for Women, Mood Swing, and Dangerous Dreams albums. Mark Campbell has just released a solo album, Tantric Machine, on Karmaceutical Records. We're going to play one more track off Tantric Machine. This one's called Strangled by Flowers, True Blood Soundtrack, 90.7 WUVT.